Hey Michael, how's it going?
Hey, how you doing, Sean?
Doing good. You're looking great, but we've got like a buzzing noise. It's like a bee above your head from the fans.
Let me mute that. Yeah, hold on. I'll be right back. Hold on.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yes, much better. All right. Before we get into Atlantis, then, can you just tell the viewers a little bit about you?
as you mentioned, I'm kind of a eclectic person. I guess relevant to this topic. I was an adjunct professor for about 15 years in Chicago area. And I taught all sorts of things: world history, World War II history, US foreign policy. And I started writing this book about 8 years ago, and I just finished it, I think, around November, December of 2022, and published it, self-published it on Amazon, just really for my friends and myself. I had never expected really anything from it. I was just interested in the topic as a kind of personal investigation. But I was quite shocked, to see its success, and just to see how many people were, still interested in a topic that I think a lot of people deep down are curious about, but are, the old story, afraid of being, well, you believe in Atlantis. And, I always tell people, well, it's not a religious belief. It's like asking, do you believe in Plato? It's just it's a question of how much of this story can we verify, given how long ago its purported demise really was?
I think what makes your angle interesting, particularly, is there's so many bizarre stories about Atlantis. But with your background in philosophy and history, it gives it credibility. So I'd be interested to start out just by asking, what is your definition of Atlantis?
That's a great question. And as part of the reason I think I really structured the book the way I did, because people throw around words all the time. The lost city, the lost continent, the lost island, the lost empire. And so just to take Plato's account, from 360 BC, which is the kind of classic account everybody cites, although it's important to know other sources did exist before that, although not as detailed. But in his account, this was a civilization at the end of the Younger Dryas period. So roughly, 9600 BC is the date he gives, and centered on a large island, probably where the Azores are now, where the Mid-Atlantic Ridge is, for a variety of reasons. But he claims just in front of the Pillars of Hercules, which are the Straits of Gibraltar, which itself had colonial dominion throughout the Mediterranean up to Egypt, which is very important. And from which he claims, and this is very interesting among many things I discovered, you could reach the whole of the other continent across the true ocean, which would imply North America. So right there, we have to wonder, how is a Greek philosopher in 360 BC transmitting a story from his distant relative 200 years before Solon, who visited Egypt? And the Egyptians told Solon the story of Atlantis, and then he told other people, Critias, Dropides, blah, blah, down through Plato. How were these people aware, number one, of the North American continent across the quote true ocean? Because he moves to great lengths to describe the Mediterranean as just an inland sea as opposed to the true ocean beyond. So this whole idea that, Columbus was the first to, discover North America with the conquistadors later, we have to look back at this account and say, well, that's a problem. And then the second question is, that date, 9600 BC, is not an arbitrary date. That's the literal mainstream, within 50 plus or minus years, date of the end of the last ice age. most likely due to cataclysm, due to flooding pattern and erosion patterns, as people like Randall Carlson and others have discovered. And
whoop, Michael, you have frozen. Let's see if you come back. Oh, dear. Uh-oh, we've lost Michael. I do apologize, viewers. Perhaps his internet has gone down. Let's give him a little bit of time, see if we can get him back on the screen. We were just getting warmed up there, weren't we? Now, because it's on locals only, I can see it says there's 28 on locals, but the chat doesn't come through to my screen, so I don't know what you're saying on locals right now. But Michael has gone. Yeah, I think his internet's gone down. So what we'll do is we'll stay on the screen. And I'm just going to get a pen and paper so I can write this down. Times where this has happened. And get this sorted out properly. Well, he's back. One second. So that was, he disappeared at 3:16 and he's back at 3:18. All right, let's bring him back on. Hey, Michael, is your internet, was it an internet thing? Or?
It was. I have no idea. That's honestly never happened before, but we'll pick up. But what I was saying is, you know, these are not just arbitrary observations, you know, because the kind of common, let's say, debunking position is that this is an allegory by a clever philosopher using this story of how his ancient relatives, the Hellenes, in his account, defeated the marauding Atlanteans and saved the Mediterranean world. But first of all, he disclaims at the beginning of these dialogues, this is not a myth. This is a true story, as strange as it sounds. That's what the character Critias says to Socrates. And then, of course, these dates that I just mentioned, how did the Egyptians, you know, who then transmitted the message to Solon, who transmitted it to Plato, how did they know that in 9600 BC there was a cataclysm? And they even say it was a comet. And they say, look, you Greeks call it the myth of Phaethon, but it's not a myth. It's not a story about a boy who borrowed his father's chariot and fell to the sky. It's an actual account of what he called a heavenly body falling to earth and burning up everything upon the earth. And then you have to begin again like children, because you Greeks don't keep records in stone like us Egyptians. So I use that as a kind of opener of the book. Like, let's just get that out of the way before we go into the more kind of unconventional sources like remote viewing or accounts from some of the most famous, you know, studied channelers like Edgar Cayce or Frederick Oliver and people like this.
So all kinds of civilizations have come and gone over the years, and some in particular, there's a focus maintained on them. But with Atlantis, it's got this mystique surrounding it. What is so special about Atlantis?
Well, if the story that I unpacked through various sources is true, then this would have been one of the longest lasting cultures in human history. You're talking a civilization that in various forms, you know, first as a large continental sized region, then as five islands, then finally the story Plato told would have been the final destruction of Atlantis, one of three. But you're still talking that it's a variously iterated civilization that would have been around for tens of thousands of years, which in our, you know, recorded history timelines, you know, what is the oldest last? I mean, think of like the Ottoman Empire was around for probably what, 900 or 1,000 years. And that's hard to believe. But to you know, the average person, some of these dates, you know, that I've discovered through like Edgar Cayce's accounts of Atlantis, you know, going back pre 50,000 BC, it's difficult for a lot of people to wrap their minds around that. But I always tell people, you know, it's not this kind of, I'm not really sure where the idea of, you know, a utopia with dolphins and Little Mermaid riding dolphins came from. Yeah, as a, you know, a beautiful region, very fertile, like the Azores are today, that had great farming and, you know, a beautiful capital city with a circular canal system that everybody's, you know, famously, you know, aware of. But the civilization itself, you know, had the same internal contradictions that we have today. You know, it was divided, according to, you know, some of my channeled sources, between essentially, you know, the same factions that are at war today. A variety of a kind of new world order, technocratic elite, eugenicists involved in hybridizing humanity with, you know, a variety of animal species, according to Edgar Cayce, but also, you know, hell-bent on defeating their kind of, you know, more spiritual and peaceful brethren who are more interested in studying kind of the natural world and how humanity related to the cosmos, and that this materialistic hedonistic faction and this other group, you know, which also is interesting because these readings, the ones I'm describing, you know, were given by the famous American clairvoyant, probably the most studied clairvoyant in the world, you know, 14,000 transcripts of his readings in an institution, Edgar Cayce. And he gave these readings in the 1930s. Before Star Wars, you know, before any of these franchises existed. And what he's describing is essentially what would later become the main factions in Star Wars, which I found absolutely interesting, you know. And I've never heard any evidence that Lucas and friends were even aware of these readings in the 70s when they were still, you know, largely relegated to archives and not a lot of people were even aware of these things. So I think actually a lot of the things we fictionalize with, you know, Marvel and with, you know, things like Star Wars, particularly Star Wars, this idea of the Jedi, the Sith, this primal duality, but also the technology, you know.
That was my next question. Yeah. How advanced were the Atlanteans?
Well, to access that information, you almost entirely have to rely on a few of these clairvoyant accounts. And before I answer that question, I'd just like to say, you know, a lot of people could say, I went into a trance and this was my past life in Atlantis and I was on the Millennium Falcon today, because we've had those cultural references. So I went to sources like, who were the first people to ever mention, like as an intellectual historian trained in, like, what is the origin of these ideas? This is how I was trained. So what was the first case of high technology Atlantis? Because in Plato's account, he's describing basically a Bronze Age civilization with, you know, megalithic architecture, but still sailing around on ships, fighting in chariots, nothing special. He doesn't describe crystals and, you know, palaces that are 3,000 feet tall and flying devices and all these things. So a lot of people understandably are like, this is just new age BS post 1960s that people have retrospectively put on to this Bronze Age tale, you know, fictional tale from Plato. But I found a book that is very difficult to just categorically deny, you know, regardless of if you think this is a true channeled account or just a teenage prodigy. And that's a book from 1882, written by a 17-year-old kid who claims to have channeled it in an automatic writing session that lasted over 2 years. He would just leave work. He was a miner in California on the frontier. Now, think about this. He lived during the Wild West, okay? Like, he had probably maybe had seen a light bulb. There were no aircraft. There was no television. certainly no cellular phones. And yet in this book, where he says, I'm going to tell a story of a past life of this voice that's speaking to me, strange as that sounds, he writes a 400-page book that's never published in his lifetime. It's a manuscript, goes into a drawer. He dies in turn of the century. His mother discovers it and publishes it. So he couldn't be financially motivated. And the level of sophistication in this book, which became a book called A Dweller on Two Planets, is so beyond. I've taught 17-year-olds and 18-year-olds for 20 years almost now. None of them could write like this. And what he's describing, to answer your question, is the first account ever that I'm aware of high technology in Atlantis. And critically, I'll describe some of that. He even explains how it declined to that 9,600 BC date that Plato was transmitting, and how it had regressed from its peak around, in his date, 11,600 BC is the date of his story. So like 2,000 years before the fall, it had reached a level that we would essentially call Star Wars. And I don't keep saying that lightly, because in one part of the book, he's talking about, well, this person who's speaking to me wants me to tell his past life in the year 11,160 BC. So again, that's an interesting date. It's that window again, you know, it's that final 2,000 years of the Ice Age. And he says, I'm a diplomat from Atlantis, and I'm leaving the principal island called Poseid, which is interesting since in Plato's account, in the capital city is a statue of Poseidon, you know, which is, I believe, Plato was describing this island of the Atlantean Empire. People talk about Atlantis as if it were this island, but it's like, is the British Empire London? No. If we found the Thames River and, you know, Big Ben, we didn't find the British Empire. We found the capital. And I think people need to remember that this was a large empire that had a global reach. And he says, in 1882, Sean, he says, I'm flying in my Vailx, V-A-I-L-X, which is a aluminum cigar-shaped object that can travel through the air and the water. Now, that's a Sanskrit word as well, and it's used to describe flying machines in Sanskrit epics that I'm pretty sure a 17-year-old kid in the Wild West did not have access to, Sanskrit epics in 1882. And it's probably where we get our word velocity from, because it went from Vailx to Velox to velocity, and it means speeder, speedy. And he goes, he describes the craft, he describes how it works, he describes what the control panel looks like. He draws a picture of it, which I put in the book, which is an amazing picture. And he says, you know, we're flying through the air, and I'm speaking to my girlfriend, who's a princess. And he's writing this in 1882, and he says, I'm talking to her on my name, N-A-I-M, which is, he's like, a handheld device that can project the moving pictures of her. You know, and it's as if she's really here in the ship. And it's like, that's Star Wars. That's Leia, you know, as the blue hologram. And it's like, where did that come from? And, you know, he goes on to describe just the kind of power sources and the science of Atlantis. And he says, you know, people in your time will ask, like, how could we achieve all these feats? You know, and I put this quote in the book. It's this like 2-page quote, because it's so extreme. And you, the burden of proof is on you to tell me how a 17-year-old kid living on the Wild West could have written this, not genuinely channeled or whatever. And he says, basically, we understood nature on a level that you are still barely scraping the surface of in this Industrial Revolution late 1800s time. He's talking to that crowd. And he says, we understood that nature was basically divinity externalized, and that everything boiled down to one substance. And so he's like, you have a periodic table and you have all this division and this metal and this. He's like, but those are all just different vibrational frequencies of the one substance. And when you understand that, you can transmute matter. And when you understand how to transmute matter, then things like, you know, large construction projects don't become so burdensome on the economy. And then he goes, and I bet you're wondering, you know, dear reader, you know, how did we Atlanteans construct all these enormous, you know, megalithic structures around the world? And he's like, it's because we possess the greatest machining tools the world has ever seen because of our ability to harness these technologies based on our much more holistic and like accurate understanding of physics and how to power things. We didn't use internal combustion. We used crystal resonant technology and all that. It's like, so I tell people, look, don't take my word for it. Even if this was written by a 17-year-old, you know, Tesla's apprentice or something, why? Why did he write this? And why did he never publish it? And what's really fascinating, and this is where I think the book, you know, the strength of the book is, I took every single thing he said when he did give a specific location, and I cross-referenced it. And so, for example, he says at one point, I bet you're wondering about what life was like in 11,160 BC in different parts of the world. And he goes, well, let me tell you, as I'm returning back from my diplomatic mission to, you know, the Indian region that you would call India today. And he goes, well, now I'm passing over what you would call Peru today, different Peru back then. And he says, in fact, as we're entering what you call the Amazon, he's like, let it be known that this is not a pristine wilderness, that much of this is transplanted from Atlantis and has been cultivated for much longer than you think. And I'm like, okay, that's a specific location, and he's describing a specific thing. Let me check that. Well, guess what? In 2020, the BBC writes an article. They say, you know, it's just occurred to a team of scientists that the Amazon jungle has been cultivated for at least 10,000 years. And it appears that much of these plant species have been transplanted from some other place we're not aware of.
Wow.
And Sean, this went on and on and on, not just with his book, but with things Edgar Cayce said, you know, and I'll just kind of touch on that. Edgar Cayce was mainly a holistic healer who discovered that he had an ability to go into a deep hypnagogic trance, kind of by accident. He had a terrible meningitis when he was a young boy. And a hypnotist cured him in Hopkinsville, Kentucky. One of his friends said, hey, you should go talk to this guy. He can maybe hypnotize you and you can diagnose your problem. And then the hypnotist said, you know, you have that ability probably because you went into a trance faster than I've seen anybody go into a trance. And so Edgar Cayce started to use this ability to heal people. That was his main thing. And there are sworn affidavits from people. Like he could non-locally view a tumor growing in Michael or Sean Atwood without us being in the room. And this was documented, as I mentioned, there's 14,000 transcripts of these readings from a stenographer and affidavits from people who were like, he literally could tell you what my room looked like without my explaining it to him in his deep sleep. And so out of this crazy, you know, man's life, he started to give people past life readings. They started asking, well, if you can non-locally view the present, can you non-locally view the past? And he said, oh, I can try. So ask me the question when I'm in my trance. And eventually, and as he started to give these topics, people would say, okay, he'd say, okay, you had a past life in Rome. But the curious thing is he, as a seventh grade, you know, dropout who only read the newspaper and the Bible, he somehow knew the entire chronology of Ming Dynasty China emperors, Roman emperors, their advisors, that even people like myself who have studied these things, we couldn't rattle these off from, let alone from a hypnagogic trance, which was being monitored by doctors because the American Medical Association sent doctors to like, who is this guy, you know, and tried to debunk him, you know, and eventually at one point put him in jail during the Rockefeller takeover of holistic medicine. But during this time period, this Atlantis question started to come up. And I think the first time he mentioned it was in like the 20s. And he's like, well, this trauma you're experiencing right now with your husband is because of a past life you both had in the second destruction of Atlantis at 28,000 BC. And his, you know, a Virginia housewife who was a devout Baptist was like, in the what? He's like, yes, in the Atlantean destruction of the White Temple in the city of Poseidon, you know, that was where this trauma started. And you're playing this out again. And so word started to get around that, okay, he's mentioning Atlantis after he's already mentioned real time periods that people have verified. Like, okay, he said the Crusades, you know, this happened and we looked it up and it was true. Or we went to this old Revolutionary War house in Virginia and indeed it was where he said it was. Is there any truth to this other story? And so a bunch of people started asking him more and more questions, specifically about Atlantis, like, when was it? How big was it? What caused the final destruction? When was the Great Pyramid at Giza built? How? That was one of the most fascinating readings he gave. And I'll save that for the book because it's very interesting the date he gives for that and how that lines up. But I'll give you just one example of something that's provable. Edgar Cayce said just casually in 1932, giving a reading of what did the world look like at the end of the last ice age. Now, we take for granted almost 100 years later that, you know, human beings are 225 to 300,000 years old in the anthropological record. We know probably exactly when, you know, and how the ice age ended. We know what the Sahara Desert looked like 12,000 years ago. But in 1932, this was not widely known among leading anthropologists, geologists. They were still coming up to speed. And he just casually says, hey, you know, the Sahara Desert used to be a verdant meadowland filled with lakes and streams and meadows around 10,500 BC during this final destruction phase of the Atlantean Empire. And he says, in fact, there used to be a huge river system that started where the Nile headwaters are and traversed all throughout Africa and emptied into the Atlantic Ocean near the Congo end of the country. And his stenographer just typed it up and put it away. Well, would you believe, Sean, that in 1986, space shuttle imaging radar determined an enormous underground river system buried under 6 feet of the Sahara Desert that ends exactly where he says it ended and starts, they believe, at the Nile? You know, it's like, you know, so I always tell people, you know, look at other authors who have written books on using non-local sources for archaeology, like Stephen Schwartz wrote a great book in the 70s called The Secret Vaults of Time, I believe, where he shows just practical cases where people were looking for a temple in Guatemala, you know, or Honduras, and they used a psychic who told them and sketched a remote view of, like, it's probably right here. You know, and the people are like, come on, like, we need it. You know, you're going to use that. And then, like, they go there and it's there. Or in his book, a case of a guy named Stephen, I believe it's Stefan Olszewski, who was a Polish. He was sadly a victim murdered by the Nazis in World War II in Warsaw. But he, before the war, he had attracted all of Europe's nobility to his house to be studied. Because he could be shown by a curator of a museum, like an object. And that curator knew this is from, you know, dynastic Egypt, 1875 BC. What do you see? And he, in a non-sleeping, but like semi-waking trance, would go back to the date of that object and tell them what was going on. He's like, I see people that look like, and they're like, that's exactly what people were wearing. You know what I mean? And like, he helped actually, I believe, the Rothschilds find missing money in London. That one of the Rothschilds flew to Olszewski and actually asked him, somebody stole a lot of money and an important document from our house and our family can't find it. And he was the one that said it was the housekeeper and he gave it to this person. And they indeed found it. You know what I mean? So this is a real thing, you know? And I used it just to kind of supplement Plato's and other people's accounts, you know, because it's difficult to get information, nearly impossible, on pre-10,000 BC, you know, Atlantis, because there's very few historical records that even talk about that, besides maybe Sumerian records or the Mahabharata. But those are difficult to kind of unpack and date themselves unless you, you know, really stretch them. You know, they're talking about advanced technology in a unspecified distant past, but it's difficult to say this has happened in Atlantis unless you go to people who have otherwise proven things with almost 100%. Edgar Cayce had like a 97% accuracy rate with medical diagnoses. And so, I, like I mentioned, he found a river, you know, he put a very interesting date for the construction of the Great Pyramid at Giza that other people in the 80s later started to think, actually, that's probably the accurate date, much older, not built as a tomb for Khufu, you know, which, again, there is no evidence. The evidence is just we don't like the fact that we don't have a good answer. So let's go with that, which is the sloppiest way of thinking, really.
So the kid who wrote the 400 pages, what was his background?
According to the Census Bureau, which is the only record of, and his preface to the book, there's really little known about this kid. He's just a kid who moved out to, you know, near Mount Shasta, California in 1880 and was a minor with his parents. And when he was 17 years old, he says in the introduction of his book, look, I'm not a great student. I'm not even religious. I don't even believe in any of this. But I started to hear voices in my head that compelled me to drop all of my studies, all of my friends, my relationship with my parents, and write a 400-page channeled account of what life was like in 11,160 BC in Atlantis. It's insane.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah, but the book is insane. And I think a lot of people just, it's such a difficult book because it's written in 19th century channeled English, which is not a particularly fun style, stylistically to read. But it's incredible, you know, what he says. Another thing he says, he goes, well, you know, we are, We're traveling back to Atlantis, and now we're passing over North America, okay? And he's like, but quite a different North America than you're used to. And he exactly delineates where we now know the ice sheet would have ended, around Dayton, Ohio, you know, which was not widely known in 1881, let alone on the frontier without a library and a geological institute and no electricity probably in his house. And then he says, and on the way back, we just stopped at one of our Atlantean copper mines in the Lake Superior region of Upper Peninsula, Michigan, where we were transmitted underground in an electric tram system. Now, would you believe that, as author Gavin Menzies, who's another historian, has mentioned, there are over 3,000 copper mines of unknown origin in Upper Peninsula, Lake Superior on, you know, Kennesaw, I believe it's called, Island, exactly where he said they were visiting their Atlantean copper mine. And to this day, nobody understands who built these copper mines because the amount of copper they extracted from this mine, or 3,000 small mines, is greater than the existing amount of copper in Bronze Age, you know, artifacts, because they dated the actual timeline to the Bronze Age. They said this mine was built in the Bronze Age and it was not built by Native Americans. So the best guess is, by the tools we found with the markings, it's probably Minoan or Phoenician or something, which itself rewrites the story that Columbus, you know, in 1492 sailed the ocean blue BS. But in his account, it actually makes more sense because we don't have that much copper in Minoan or Phoenician museums or archaeological sites. But in his account, that was all copper that was taken back to probably where the Mid-Atlantic Ridge is now, where the Azores Islands are in the, you know, which would have been the mountain peaks of Atlantis, and probably are at the bottom of the ocean because they were probably used to help, you know, build the capital city. Because one of the things Plato says is one of the, you know, metals they used to ring one of the four walls was copper or a calcum, which means mountain copper in Greek. So it's like, again, these are very specific. He didn't say, we're going to visit our copper mines in Miami, Florida. He's like, the upper peninsula of Lake Michigan, where they just happened to find 3,000 copper mines. So again, I think what's going on here is that, like, you know, I'm not qualified to speak about, you know, quantum entanglement in time, although I had to look into that for the book just to be kind of cognizant of it. But I think what's going on is that, like, if time is indeed concurrent, or if there's like a psychic barrier, you know, that's being breached from the past, I think it is possible that what these people were doing was indeed accessing some either concurrent reality, believe what you will, or maybe it's a completed reality that, because of reincarnation, certain energies or people from that time are back today. You know, it could very well be the case.
Well, what about Carl Jung's theory of archetypes? Because he said that you can tap into the collective conscience and there are archetypes and symbols and knowledge that are right. passed down without you accessing it externally. So couldn't right. the channeling and the writing of the book be an extreme example of this collective conscious knowledge being channeled through the kid?
Absolutely. And I'm glad you brought up Carl Jung, because I actually talked about that in the book. He's in the final chapter. Because again, I have to ask myself, like, is this a Jungian, you know, upwelling from the collective unconscious? I believe absolutely it's true. What's also interesting is that Carl Jung was an advocate of reincarnation. He even said that in a personal letter I found, where he's like, I feel like my own life in this life is just an incomplete fragment of something much greater, that I could not have arrived at this knowledge in this lifetime. Henry Ford said the same thing, you know, and it's quite interesting that Edgar Cayce gave a reading to one of Henry Ford's top executives. You know, he wasn't just giving readings to housewives. One of Henry Ford's top executives in the 30s came there. And it was very interesting what role Henry Ford played in Atlantis, as a character named Ajax Ole. But I think you're right. And I also think that, you know, Edgar Cayce was asked one time directly, how are you doing this, when he was in a trance? And he basically, again, without knowing Carl Jung's work and being a Sunday school teacher when he wasn't in a trance state, he said, I'm accessing the superconscious mind. And he says, everything that exists or passes on the earth plane is recorded in an etheric record. You might call it the Akashic record. And again, quite interesting that he picked Akasha, because Akasa in Sanskrit means ether. You know, so he's like, it's in the cosmic ethernet, basically. And so I think what we're doing today is, like, I'm talking to you over ethernet, you know, that's why it cut out, because it's, you know, it's so good. But we're speaking over ethernet, and yet we deny ether exists, but we subconsciously use the language of it, you know. And these people were talking about the Akashic records. What is the Akashic records? Cut out the woo aspect and just say, what is Akasha in Sanskrit? It's the ether records. It's the ether, it's the cosmic cloud, basically, of a much more intelligent and sophisticated cosmic computing system, if you want to go backwards and look at, you know, like as if we are smarter than the universe, and say that it's the cloud. It's the cloud of all history, you know, that that Stephen Ossevicki said he could access, that Edgar Cayce, that Frederick Oliver, they're all tapping into this, like, you know, the past did exist. And even if you haven't found a record of it, the etheric traces of it are accessible to those with this rarefied ability. You know, that's why I called the book Visions of Atlantis, I guess, is a double entendre, because it's like, it's literal visions from psychics, but it's also, how did historians and other cultures view this? Because it's not just a book about psychics. They supplement the kind of 70% of the book that's just quite hardcore archaeology, geology, oceanography, anthropology, etc.
So on the subject of reincarnation, then, what about the theory that, you know, if you go back millions of years to what we're descended from, something in primordial soup, something that swam, something that crawled, etc., we have reincarnated that DNA, haven't we, to become what we are presently? And Nietzsche said that we're a bridge. Is that a bridge for DNA? And how does that tie in to your theories?
That's a great question. You know, I don't know. I don't claim to know the origin point. It's a difficult question. It's like one of my favorite British authors, John Fowles. He wrote a book. He wrote a lot of books, novels, but he wrote one book where he actually says that. He's like, you know, we always talk about this, like human beings emerged at this point and blah, 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 as if we understand what that even means. He's like, how could you put a date on when the first hominid became aware of itself? Like, how would you even, what test is there for that? You know, I think what's really interesting is Edgar Cayce was once asked these questions, like, what was the origin point of humanity? And basically his story is quite interesting. He says, he gives very strange dates. He says, look, 10.5 million years ago, there was an influx of souls who wanted to experiment in Earth dimensionality. And they entangled with the pre-existing flora and fauna of the Earth and created this kind of strange world that you wouldn't really recognize today, where you had people with connected to trees, you had people that were kind of hybridized mutants. And he says, over time, over millions of years, you know, 10 million years down to the 500,000 and even later point, he's like, there had to come another soul to free those people from their experiment in materiality where they were trapped. And he claims that the same Christ consciousness that went into Yeshua or Jesus of Nazareth was present around 100,000 years ago on the earth near Atlantis, where he was trying to create a better vessel to contain consciousness from these lost souls that were running around, trapped, as he called, or entangled. And as strange as that sounds, it's like, well, I mean, do you have a better answer? Like a monkey woke up and scratched his head and then you and me are here? Like, I don't think I do. I'm not saying that's the truth. I'm just saying, look, that's what this guy who was very accurate with everything else said. And, you know, when he said the date of the origin of the human species, he put it around 200,000 BC. In 1932, when people still thought human beings were 9,000 years old in 1932, a lot of people thought that, you know, a lot of very smart people thought that, you know, that in the lead up to World War II, human beings had not been on the earth 200,000. That's a very, you know, last 30, 40 years of anthropology. So I tend to think perhaps he's right. I don't know. And maybe it explains a lot of these myths of the mutants you see in mythology, or even Tolkien's idea of the tree folk in these things, you know? And Tolkien, I cite in the book, because Tolkien was a huge believer in Atlantis, or a huge proponent of Atlantis. And he even said that it inspired the island of Numenor in my Lord of the Rings trilogy.
Wow.
And he says, I have nightmares every night about the destruction by a flood of Atlantis. That's J.R. Tolkien. And, you know, it's like the Lord of the Rings, Star Wars, Edgar Cayce, Frederick Oliver. None of these people were communicating with each other. And yet they're all in two channeled accounts that are, you know, talking about a lived reality, and then two fictional accounts talking about, you know, the Shire and then the Star Wars, you know, worlds. They're all talking about what essentially both of these two channelers said was actually going on planet Earth 12,000 years ago,
your internet's going. Let's have a look.
Is it something? Continent.
Yeah, we lost you a little bit there. We've only got 10 minutes left, Michael. Mm-hmm. What you've touched on it there, flood.
Sure.
What caused the demise of Atlantis then?
Well, I'll leave the first two destructions for the readers, because they beggar belief, even for the most probably open mind, because they, according to Edgar Cayce, the first two were human caused through a misapplication of a basically scalar weapon. The third destruction would have been natural and most likely caused by a comet and a series of comet fragments hitting the Earth. And I should add, Sean, that, you know, it's very interesting that in the Mahabharata, which is 1,000 years older than Plato, at least, or at least 700 years before Plato's account of Atlantis, would you believe that in the Mahabharata in India, they describe the island of Atala in the Western Ocean sinking into the sea 10,000 years ago? And in the Mahabharata, we get the Yuga cycles, and they talk about, again, how did these people 3,000 years plus ago know that it takes about 25,000, you know, 800 years for the Earth to go through all the constellations in the sky in the precession of the equinox? And would you believe that they, of one of the precessions of in about 9600 BC and 10,900 BC? And that's exactly the cataclysmic window for the Younger Dryas, and when people think that the Earth was probably passing through the toroid asteroid field, you know, and major comet impacts all over the Earth, probably one in South Carolina off the coast, maybe one hit the ice sheet and precipitated massive flooding. And what's interesting is that in the Yuga cycle, there's two destructional periods that are about equidistant. One is the one we're entering in 2 years, called Ekpyrosis, which is the cleansing by the fire. And then the other was called Cataclysmos, which is the destruction by the flood. And that ends around 9600 BC, exactly what Plato said. So it's like you've got Indians talking about Atala 10,000 years ago. You've got Egyptians talking about, you know, hey, there was this place called Atlantis, you know, that was destroyed 9,600 years ago by a comet. You know, you've got a Aztec, which is a word that means the people from Aztlan. So you figure that out. The Aztec culture, who built megalithic structures that they themselves said we did not build, who have a god who's holding the world on his shoulders called Atlanteotl, which is their version of Atlas, which is before Columbus arrived there. So it's like, I look at the big picture. And to explain these cultural similarities, it actually makes much more sense that the Atlantic used to have a large landmass and it allowed it to be navigable, and that we were much more advanced than we give ourselves credit for. You know, I think it's our own arrogance, if I may end, that precludes us from thinking that, you know, the Egyptians didn't use high technology to build an impossibly sophisticated structure, but that they had to use slaves
Oop, lost you again. See if Michael comes back. Sorry about this, folks. Write this one down, 401. Absolutely fascinating, though, Pete, about the internet.
I do apologize, Sean.
Oh, it's all right. Yeah,
we're almost done. Mexican Wi is not. You don't want to do high speed financial transactions on Mexican Wi-Fi. I got to tell you that.
Well, look, this has been absolutely fascinating, Michael. Do you want to tell the viewers then where they can find your book and support you?
Well, first of all, I just like to say it came as such a surprise to be invited on your show, because I've been watching the True Crime Podcast for about, as long as I think it's been around. So when I got the email, I was like, well, I didn't write a book about crime. They said, no, actually, he's into all sorts of weird things. So thank you for the invite. First of all, I'm a big fan. I don't know how you get some of these people to sit down with you. It's amazing. But if you want to learn something, and not be told what to think, just look at this with an open mind. You can buy the book of Atlantis, Reclaiming Our Lost Ancient Legacy on Amazon. And if you like to contact me, you have a question, you could go to my website, michaelleflem.com. And I always love to hear from people, you know, what they thought from reading the book. And you know, it's not something I wrote to prove anything. I really was just seeing so many people kind of talking over each other when there, to me, needed to be a much greater synthesis of information, you know, because most archaeologists aren't going to look at remote viewing. Most remote viewing, you know, people aren't going to naturally look at, say, philosophical angles, you know. So I tried to use all of my training as a professional historian and professor, but also go kind of outside of the realm and bring a new kind of fresh aspect, but also show you, you know, don't just take my word for it. Listen to all the testimonies of the people that knew these channelers, and you get a kind of mini biography of their lives and times. And that's kind of how the book progresses. It takes you from, you know, Plato to today, and you get to see what people in the Middle Ages, people in Rome, people in Greece, people in India, what did all these cultures say about this subject? Because I think you'd be surprised that the, you know, of the evidence, the debunking crowd is less than 1% of the accumulated opinions of Atlantis, which is that this was a lived reality and one day we might, you know, come closer to the truth. But very few people denied that this was a serious subject until quite recently, which I think is important for people to know, you know.
All right. Please support Michael, viewers, and Visions of Atlantis needs to be on the reading list. Huge thank you for spending time with us, Michael, and enjoy the rest of your day. Cheers.
Thank you so much, Sean. All right.
Thank you. Bye-bye.